Well, thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Growing Leaders Podcast. Today, we've got Dr. Tim Elmore in the studio with us, and we've got a very special guest today, Dr. Jean Twenge. She holds degrees from the University of Chicago and the University of Michigan. Her work has appeared in many outlets, including Time Magazine, USA Today, and the New York Times. Dr. Twenge is the author of 3 books, and her most recent being Generation Me. She is currently a professor at San Diego State University. Dr. Twenge, we are honored to have you today.
Yes, we are, Gene. Thanks for joining us. Gene, I have kind of scribbled out 7 questions that I would love to ask you. I probably could ask you 700, but if you're willing to take a few minutes and answer these 7, I think it's going to be so helpful for our listeners. Thanks for joining us today, by the way.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. My first question, just as kind of a macro question, talk about what you do in addition to your teaching psychology at SDSU. You've been a part of some time lag studies of students that has been going on for years now. Talk about that.
Yeah, so I got interested in generational differences in graduate school. So a long time ago, you know, 20 mm-hmm. years ago now, yeah. I was originally interested in gender roles and noticed, of course, that women's gender roles were a little different than they had been a generation or two before. So that made me realize, wait, it goes way beyond that. There are other generational differences too. So I do, a number of different types of studies, and in almost all of them, we're looking at people who are the same age, but at different points in time. And that's great because then we can say, well, it's generation or the specific time period someone's living in. It's not just that someone is young or old or, in the prime of life, why they have certain traits or characteristics. So there's kind of basically 2 different types of studies that I've been involved in. One has this fancy name, cross-temporal meta-analysis. Basically, it just means we look at the average scores of children or college students most of the time on different psychological scales. And with that, we've been able to trace some psychological traits all the way back to the 1930s. Now, I've also looked at some big databases that other institutes and people have collected. So the Monitoring the Future study of high school students, they also look at 8th graders and 10th graders, and then the American Freshman Study of entering college students. And those go back to the 50s and 60s, so they also give a pretty long view of generational change.
One of the things I love about what you've done is you've helped the average person like me really interpret those changes. You're right. Some things are just students, freshmen or freshmen, but there have been some shifts in culture, and it's been so helpful for you to help us really interpret those and know what we should do. Gene, take a minute and share with us the big picture observations and really conclusions that you've drawn about students that have led to books like Generation Me. You really identified narcissistic tendencies in these students. Talk about that for just a minute.
Sure. So, we call the book Generation Me because if you really look at the generational changes, they're rooted in the changes in our culture. And this gets around another misperception. People sometimes say, why are you blaming this generation? It's the baby boomers' fault or it's the media's fault. Well, first of all, we don't need to talk about fault or blaming. Yeah. This is cultural change. I don't think we need to even use that language. But generations reflect changes in our culture. So we need to take that broader view. It's very helpful. And when you think about how our culture has changed since, let's say, 1970, well, yes, we've had changes in technology. People often think of those first. But in terms of our values and what we teach our kids and what our young adults come to expect out of life, really the biggest change across the board, the theme that comes up over and over and over is individualism. Mm-hmm. More focus on the self, less focus on social roles, communalism, and other people. And that's why we ended up and I say we because it was the coming up with the title was a collaborative process, even though I was the one who wrote the book. That was the idea, Generation Me, because that is the focus on self. So, yes, the first studies were looking at self-esteem and positive self-views. And then a few years into it, we did also find that more extreme forms of individualism and positive self-view, such as narcissism, had also increased over the generations and were higher among this group. But it's not just those negative things. There's also positive things, or usually positive things, like self-esteem that are higher, positive self-views. The downside is sometimes those positive self-views are not based in reality, so they can sometimes cross over into being negative. And that's where a lot of the problems that this generation faces, in my view, that's where a lot of them are rooted.
I totally agree. In fact, in our work, we work with really tens of thousands of students every year. Obviously, we love it when they have a healthy sense of self-esteem, where self-regard is high. However, there's this crash and burn thing that happens sometimes at 25, a quarter-life crisis, because it was not rooted in where their gifts really lay. It was rooted in mama saying you're awesome and Facebook allowing them to have, you know, this platform, and it really wasn't about we, it was about me. So I think you're spot on in us needing to help kids grow up, and that means it's about something much bigger than me.
Exactly, and I think that's what we have to come back to. So, you know, one of our most closely held cultural beliefs in the U.S. today is that self-esteem, thinking highly of yourself, is really, really important, especially kids. So the thinking is that we need to boost their self-esteem, give them a trophy just for showing up, give them lots of praise, give them A's, all of those things. And that's all happened. Giving A's, we can document that very empirically, great inflation, and that is real. I've seen that in these big data sets. It's very, very clear. Twice as many high school students graduating with an A average, even though fewer do 10 or more hours of homework. So we have this problem of this disconnect between the self-views and the actual performance. See, we've gotten the idea that just thinking you're great is the same as actually being great.
Yeah,
and of course,
yeah.
it's not. And that's where a lot of the problems lie. Now, yes, we do want to encourage kids. We do want them to have what's called self-efficacy of, I think I can do this.
Yes.
But that's a different thing from, I'm awesome, I'm great, all I need to do is show up.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's when I'm thinking about the outcomes, if I think I'm awesome because I've just shown up, that's not going to translate into the workplace very well, you know, where the boss
exactly.
isn't clapping for them because they showed up at work on Monday on time. So, Jean, you just finished a study showing that teens today are displaying more psychosomatic symptoms of depression, like trouble sleeping and remembering. I think it'd be great to touch on this. This is brand new stuff, and this is very helpful to know.
Yeah, so this was from that high school student survey for 12th graders, and it goes back to 1976. So we're able, in this case, though, those questions about those psychosomatic symptoms go back to about, I think it's 1985. So basically we're comparing Generation X from the 80s and 90s to what's sometimes called the millennials, or I call them Generation Me, so a generation who's in the 2000s and then in high school now in the 2010s. So This survey is great. You know, it's huge. It's, you know, about 500,000 young people. It's an age where we need to know more about high school students. It's an age where, as parents, we can, you know, still shape them, and we still are, you know, worrying about them and are going to launch them into the world. And we did find, so the 1980s compared to more recently, more and more teens are saying, I have trouble sleeping, I have trouble concentrating, I have trouble remembering. And these are psychosomatic symptoms of depression. They show up on a lot of standard depression inventories. What's interesting, though, is we looked in the college student sample as well. If you ask them straight out, are you depressed or have you felt depressed in the last year, you don't get a change in that. There's not more teens now who are saying yes to that compared to the 80s. So that could be because antidepressants came on the scene right at that time in the early 90s, right during that transition. So maybe the people with the most severe issues are getting the help they need. For example, the teen suicide rate, thankfully, is down over that same time period. But we still have more teens saying they have these lower-level symptoms, but there's more of them. So these are perhaps less severe problems, but still cause suffering, and they're experienced by many more people than experience severe depression. So in that way, it's just as worrisome.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that kind of leads me into my next question. I think you and I both share a concern about the mental health of adolescents today. And part of it is you just talked about. It's what you just talked about. It's not a deep level, but it's at least a wide level of kids that just wrestle with feeling good about life. And by the way, isn't this ironic? At least on a surface level, these kids have been said they're amazing, and here's the trophy and the ribbon and so forth. And yet the very same kid 5 years later is really wrestling with, with their place. So I'd love for you to talk about, are your concerns for the mental health of students growing? And if so, why?
You know, I think there's science, there's both good and bad signs in this area. I think it's extremely encouraging that the teen suicide rate is down.
Yes.
It's great that we don't have much of a difference 80s versus now, people saying, you know, that they feel depressed. These are very, very, very good signs. Yeah. But on the other hand, if you talk to young people, even apart from any of this empirical evidence, which is, you know, nice and strong, but still just talking to young people, they talk about how stressed they are a lot.
Yeah.
And in that college student survey, there's a question, do you feel overwhelmed by all you have to do? And sure enough, today's students are more likely to say yes to that.
Yeah.
And I think that really, really gets to the issue. I think when you talk to this generation, they will tell you everything is so competitive.
Yeah,
I'm so stressed out about getting into college or doing well in college or finding a good job. Stress is a word they use a lot.
Absolutely. In fact, I remember one study I read said that 94% of college students, at least from this one survey, said the number one word they use to describe their life is overwhelmed. Now, I got to be honest with you. On the one hand, I totally see this. Things are competitive. I mean, parents feel like they want some ROI on this kid, you know, make the grade, make the team, make the money. On the other hand, sometimes I see them getting stressed out over the smallest things, you know, tiny things like I made a C and I broke up with my girlfriend. And of course, I want to say sometimes, hey, that's the least of your worries in 5 years. You need to celebrate right now, you know, because where this is going actually gets very stressful. But that's me. Talk to me about, is there more stress or, you know, than what you and I had when we were growing up? Or is it we're dealing with it different? Are our coping mechanisms different now? I don't mind this just being from you and your observations as a professor. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of things going on. I mean, I think, you know, for one thing, I think as we get older, we forget just how stressful it is to be young.
Yeah, yeah.
And we do need to take the perspective a little bit and step back, which is a hard cognitive exercise, but one of the best things that you can do to try to understand someone else is just try to think about what it's like to be them. And you know, think back to when you were young and how you might remember a lot of the good things about the freedom that you had and how good you felt. But you also, if you think hard, might remember how uncertainty can be really stressful. And not having a steady romantic relationship and always wondering, you know, pining for someone when you have a crush or, you know, going through a bad breakup, you know, those things inherently are really stressful. So in that way, we can kind of understand what they're going through. But yes, on the other hand, it very well could be that this generation just doesn't have the resources to cope with some of the smaller bumps in life, perhaps because we gave them so much praise and sheltered them so much. Some people use the analogy of we wrap kids in bubble wrap and we make sure that they don't fail. But then that also means we don't prepare them for how to fail and how to cope with those experiences.
Absolutely. I think we see that particularly in middle class and upper middle class America, especially. It's kind of a new at-risk population.
Yeah.
Well, let me shift gears just slightly, but you've also reported that trust is at an all-time low among young adults, college students, et cetera, in America. Talk to us about this, and what does this mean for us who lead them?
Yeah, so this we drew from that same 12th grader survey and then also a survey of adults and found very, very similar results in both populations that between the 1970s and the present, people are much less likely now to say that they trust other people, which is really worrisome. Political scientists talk about trust being the foundation of what they call social capital. In other words, this is what we really need in a democratic society and in the economic system is to trust each other, that things kind of break down when we don't have that. People also don't trust large institutions as much as they used to. So not just government, which we can all kind of understand, but even medicine or the scientific community or the media are not trusted as much as they used to be.
Yeah.
So I think this is part of this shift toward I'm just going to depend on me and nobody else knows what they're doing and I'm not going to trust anybody else. But it's a very worrisome trend. And I think it's something we really need to change. It does appear to be a product of our times and not necessarily of this generation, according to the stats we're able to do on it.
Yeah.
But the young adults, they're living in this time. So we need to try to reach them and work on some of these issues around trust in individual other people and in large institutions. We need them to work together. We need to all work
Absolutely.
Together to solve some of these, these problems. We need that foundation of trust to do so.
Yeah, no doubt about it. As I'm listening to you talk, I'm thinking of in the year 2000, Howe & Strauss came out with Millennials Rising. And at that point, those were the early millennials they were talking about. Trust was high. I mean, they were very, you know, civically engaged, et cetera, at least what they were reporting. And it does seem like there's been a measurable drop in that age range, looking at Wall Street and saying, I don't know if I can trust you guys. You're just in it for the buck. And Washington, D.C., I think you guys are just in it for yourselves and reelection. And it is scary because these are our next politicians and our next business leaders who will be entering the workforce if they don't change this mindset with this very individualistic, I'm just looking out for number one mindset. I don't think you can build a civilization well on that. That is scary.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and it is true, these things do go up and down, and yes, things look a little more rosy in the early 2000s, but they've gotten considerably worse. For both adolescents and adults, we found that both trust and confidence in others reached all-time lows. So it's really kind of shocking when you think about it that there was more trust and confidence in institutions in the 1970s during Watergate. In the early 1990s, when it was at a low then too, because of the high crime rate, for example.
Yeah.
But not as low as it is now, which is weird because in many ways this is a pretty good time.
Yeah.
But there's I think it's some of it's the individualism. Some of it might be the economy.
Yeah.
Though we looked at economic factors, that didn't seem to be the explanation. There's just something about this time period that's rotten. And I don't know, Jackie, it's hard to put your finger on exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Income inequality could be part of it is one thing we found.
Sure, no doubt about it. And, you know, the intangible, I also think, Gene, is I think kids are more savvy than ever. We are so exposed to information that makes us at least feel savvy. Love, I know what your motive is. You're really doing this for this reason. And so we really don't think that maybe this is for an altruistic reason that you're serving this community now. We question it. And our heroes, even from yesteryear, now we know the dirty laundry on them.
Mm-hmm.
We're just savvy. And sometimes being savvy means we're no longer innocent. We're very distrustful about what's really going on in the dark parts of their mind. Well, Gene, all this leads us to really my point in bringing this up. I so appreciate, as I've said, what you've done to help us interpret what's happening. But for educators, parents, youth workers who are listening, what are some ways that we can lead students into more healthy lifestyles? As mm-hmm. every one of us wants these kids to become great adults, the best version of themselves.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some ideas on what we can do right now.
Well, I think the first thing is to move away from this cultural movement of boosting self-esteem and empty praise and giving a trophy for showing up.
Yeah.
So let me give you an example.
Okay.
Well, first, we know that self-esteem, basic self-esteem is good, but it's not actually linked to success in life. And here's an example. In the United States, the ethnic group with the lowest self-esteem is Asian Americans.
Oh,
and those are the kids
yeah.
who have the best academic performance.
The
adults get the most education and have the highest median income. By a lot of measures, they're the most successful ethnic group, as well as being the ethnic group with the lowest self-esteem. Of course, this is a cultural thing because that's a culture that does not place as much importance on feeling good about yourself.
Yeah.
Instead, it places emphasis on hard work and self-improvement. And I think we can all take a lesson from that, that really is, and the research is pretty clear on this too, that's what really leads to success: perseverance, self-control, hard work, having perhaps a realistic or even slightly pessimistic view in some cases, of your own abilities, not thinking, oh, this paper is going to take me 2 hours to write.
Right.
Well, why don't you plan on it taking 6 hours and then you can be pleasantly surprised.
Absolutely.
And just keep working at it. And I you do need to have enough self-confidence to say, okay, I can go and try at this. But you have to realize that it's that hard work that's going to really make you succeed, mm-hmm. not the pure self-belief.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and something else, if I can just volley back on this, that we have picked up is not only is self-esteem purely based on success and certainly academic success, it's also not based purely on affirmation. You know, a mother saying you're awesome all a kid's life, pretty soon, you know, he reaches middle school or high school and realizes mom's the only one saying this to me. Nobody yeah. else is saying this. And so there's a reality check, I think, that needs to happen that doesn't thrust them into the other extreme, depression, but into
right.
realism. Now I realize here's my gifts. This is the value I can add to a team. Let me move forward now realistically.
And as a parent, I have three kids myself. So yeah. people sometimes say, what do you mean you're not supposed to overpraise school? What do you mean you're not supposed to say you're special to kids? You're not supposed
yeah.
to say you're awesome. Like, say I love you. It's
yeah.
what you mean
yes.
anyway. And
yeah.
as a parent, that's the thing that they really need from you anyway. And then
mm-hmm.
you have plenty of that to give, more than likely. So that's what you want to share with them. And yes, when they do good work, of
yes.
course, tell
yes.
them that they've done
yes.
well. But not for showing up and not for when you can tell they haven't actually tried.
Absolutely. In fact, let me volley back on that. It's so interesting. Just read a report on student athletes. And, you know, student athletes feel pressured. They've not only got all the normal pressures of an undergraduate degree, but then they got 40 hours a week they're putting into sport. Oftentimes, mom or dad becomes another coach. You know, they've got their head coach, their assistant coach, and now mom and dad are doing the armchair quarterbacking thing. These students basically said, the thing I would love to hear most from mom and dad is simply these words, I love watching you play. Has nothing to do with, yeah, great touchdown or you know, great free throw or whatever. Certainly they know those were great touchdowns. But just, isn't that liberating? I love watching you play.
I like that too.
Yeah, absolutely. Good. Well, any other thoughts real quick before we kind of wrap up? I love these practical insights on being real and affirming in a realistic way. Any other thoughts that come to mind? Maybe for an educator, you're a teacher. What do you do in your class that you feel like helps maybe balance some of these too good and too bad extremes?
So I think you have to give this generation what they want in some ways, but you also have to give them what they need and what they may not always know what they need. So sure, you can give them a lot of the things that they may want, like an example, your lectures with a lot of videos and discussion and things.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing really wrong with that. It's going to lead to learning, and
yep.
they like it.
Yep.
You know, being friendly and encouraging them to ask questions and all of that. They like that too. But I do think you have to. The rule I always come back to as a faculty member in dealing with students is that sometimes I need to have the mindset, not always, but a lot of times the mindset that works the best is imagining that I'm their manager 5 years from now.
Good.
Because when they say, oh, I have to take the final late because I'm going to Vegas for my birthday.
yeah.
Well, how is the boss going to react to you?
Mm-hmm.
I can't show up for the big presentation because I'm going to Vegas to my birthday.
Yeah.
So I'm maybe not going to react as strongly as the manager, who might just tell them they're fired.
Right.
But I will tell them, I'm sorry, we have 500 people in this class. We cannot reschedule the final, and we can't do a makeup. It is just not practical. So this is the time of the final. And so that's also spelled out on the syllabus, so they know to expect this from the beginning.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to hold your ground on some of these things, even if you feel bad about it, and I certainly do sometimes.
And
you have to make some provisions for people actually being in the hospital and so on.
Sure. Yeah.
Like, we just won't count that as part of your grade at all. It just won't count for you or against you.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
some kind of way for them to recognize, well, wait a second, there are some standards here that I have to follow, because they need to learn that lesson, because otherwise they're going to learn it the hard way in the workplace.
When the stakes are way higher and maybe their livelihood.
Higher.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Jean, this is so good. This has been so helpful. I appreciate the practicality, but also the research, what you're finding. I'm hoping we can do this again sometime. Thanks again for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
You bet.
Well, thanks for joining us on this episode of the Growing Leaders Podcast. If you would like to stay current with Jean's work, you can go check out her newly updated book, Generation Me, on Amazon.com. Her newly updated version has a special chapter about Generation Me in the workplace. Tim, one thing that you and I have talked about is that we believe that this starts in the home. When you're raising a child, we believe that if you start them off in the right path with the right training, years down the road, it's going to turn out a whole lot better. Your most recent book, 12 Huge Mistakes Parents Can Avoid, addresses this topic and gives us a handle on what we can practically do. So if you'd like to check out our book, you can go to growingleaders.com and purchase a copy there. Until next time, thanks for joining us on this episode of the Growing Leaders Podcast.